I will go around and greet people by name, starting with Mark W., Bob K., David, Jinryu, Jim, Paulette, Marv, Sam, Shoketsu, Pat, Amanda, Ken, Mary, Charles, Joan, Bonnie, John, Abdullah, Bruce, Coral, and Carson might be there too, I don't know. welcome. Oh, and then Soon, just in time. All right. Well, welcome everyone. Welcome everybody from all around the country. I try to memorize where everybody's from, but I know, let's see, Paulette's in California, Marv's in Vancouver, BC, Ken is in Spain, Charles, remind me.
I'm in Wisconsin.
All right, Wisconsin. Bonnie, I forget.
Coming in from Maine.
Yep.
Maine. And Abdullah is Connecticut, right? All right. And John is in Texas. Cool. So I don't know that us Oregonians are outnumbered, but it's pretty close. Let's see. In terms of announcements, I guess nothing particularly special. I have started filling in the calendar of events for 2021. So it's pretty complete through June. But I think there's also, fingers crossed, like an August session on the calendar. And, you know, like, who knows? I still have the reservation at the retreat facility. So, yeah. So if you want to, you know, especially like between up until the summer, I do have like 1-day retreats on there and a term student program and stuff like that. So if you want to start filling that in and planning around those things, that would be good. Can't think of anything else in particular. We're just going to continue with the Norman Fisher book on Tuesdays. Anybody else think of anything that I should be mentioning? We're continuing to have our lovely newsletter feature with showing people's personal altars. So if you haven't already submitted a picture of your altar, please do so to info@brightwaysend.org or in the newsletter. You'll see that there's a link.
Mary, is your book group on the calendar? Have you noticed yet?
Yes, I scheduled it all in. It should be third Saturdays.
Great. Like,
without fail.
Yeah.
And at least through summer. I know it's all working through summer. So that sure. In the fall, I haven't fully scheduled fall yet, but.
We can make it work no matter what, so that's fine.
Any questions or anything? Ken?
Are those events going to be Zoomable or some of
yes.
them?
Yes. So for those of you who have started participating in our Sangha virtually, our plan is that when we do start meeting in person again, so obviously everything's online until then, but even when we do start meeting in person again, we are committed to making our stuff, all of our main events, also accessible online. We would lose half our Sangha now if we didn't. And I think a lot of people, even people who live, you know, somewhat locally, like Pat, still live a bit of a ways from the Zen Center. So I think there will still be online use even from people who theoretically could drive. Let's see. Hello to Amelia and Candace and Nick as well, and Jessica. All right, so today's talk, and I apologize if you are a regular listener of the podcast and you've already listened to the episode that I released Friday. This is the same topic, but hopefully it just feels a little different as a Dharma talk and you get a chance to ask questions and stuff like that. So this is on bodhicitta and the critical importance of dissatisfaction. So bodhicitta is the mind that seeks the way, and I'll talk more about it. So the gist of this is that my wish for you, my New Year's wish for you, is that you be dissatisfied with your practice and with your Marxist check. May you be profoundly dissatisfied. And that doesn't sound like a very nice New Year's wish, but I will explain. I guess what I mean is that I hope that each one of you has a sense of, what comes to mind is in Genjo Koan, Dogen talks about, like, when you first encounter the Dharma, you kind of think you have it. But when you get more into the Dharma, you realize how much you don't know, how much more there is. So I guess that's that sense of not being complacent, of questioning, of wondering what more is there? What haven't I seen? What potential have I not yet fulfilled? You know, what growth and learning is still possible in this life? My teacher, Gyokoko, called this the habit of profound thought, where everything that we encounter, every obstacle we encounter in ourselves or in the world, and there's some kind of trouble or conflict or whatever, that we look deeply at it. And we ask what deeper spiritual issue is reflected in this turbulence, in this dissatisfaction, and always looking at it as there's something underneath all of our issues. It's not just a matter of, oh, I have this bad habit, or I react badly to that, or this makes me sad. There's something underneath that we can learn from, that theoretically we can gain insight into, that we can practice with, and we can resolve. So everything is of significance in our life and practice. And that I would wish for you that you would have a sense of what Shanti Deva is referring to here, the way of the Bodhisattva. He said, so hard to find such ease and wealth whereby to render meaningful this human birth. If now I fail to turn it to my profit, how could such a chance be mine again? And I want to be dissatisfied with my life in all these ways too. So this may seem kind of out of keeping with Buddhist teaching, seeing as the whole point of Buddhism is to let go of dissatisfaction. Or dukkha, right? Dukkha, which can be translated as suffering, but that's kind of, you know, at the more acute end, or dis-ease, dissatisfactoriness, a sense that things aren't quite right. But Buddha's whole point was to identify this and to let it go. And there is a way that we can, it's possible, maybe you've achieved it or not, or maybe you've achieved it for a few moments at a time. It's possible to give up the desire to be free from dissatisfactoriness, right? Or give up the desire for any improvement, or give up the desire for making any progress in practice, or give up the desire, and now you're free from suffering. Just like that. If you just don't wish for things to be anything different, then in a way there's instant access to greater ease and dissatisfaction. I mean, there's no denying that sometimes our practice, our aspirations, our ideals can actually cause us some suffering, because now we just have something else that we want, something else to compare with our current state. But if this is all we do is just, well, I'm, you know, I wish that I understood more. I wish that I was less inhibited. I wish that I could be more intimate with people. I wish these things, but if I just give up wishing for them and just, you know, be satisfied with who and what I am, then I can be, I'm at ease, right? That there, like I said, there's some value to that, but if that's all we do, then this becomes what's called spiritual bypassing. It's using the tools, the spiritual tools, to kind of jump over our problems. It's like we don't need to resolve any of our issues or increase our understanding or let go of our attachments. We'll just apply these techniques and feel better. Which sometimes, like I said, that's a completely valuable thing to be doing. But if that's all we do, then we don't actually improve our understanding or resolve some of these deep-seated things that cause us suffering over time. On the other hand, of course, we do not want to get into that kind of fruitless struggle with ourselves that causes suffering, right? So then it's the ideal, I'm not measuring up, feeling inadequate or insufficient, or pitting ourselves against ourselves. I want to do this, but then, you know, my unruly appetites or mind or body or whatever refuses to comply. And most of us find that this is not, if it worked, I don't know that it would be so bad, but it doesn't actually seem to work, or at least not in any kind of sustainable or long-term way. So we want to avoid that kind of fruitless struggle. So how do we allow dissatisfaction with our practice to arise, but not get caught in those negative karmic patterns? And so what I'm going to be talking about today is basically, I guess you could say, two steps. Is like to identify useful dissatisfaction. Dissatisfaction you can actually do something about. And then taking that dissatisfaction and transforming it into bodhicitta, this determination to find a way. So in some senses, it's good. You know, what's the problem with satisfaction? It's good to try to find ways not to experience these negative things associated with dissatisfaction. A kind of annoyance, agitation, complaining, disappointment, you know, being fretful and critical, envious. One of the synonyms I looked up was insatiable. You know, just if you're always dissatisfied, it's a kind of hungry ghost situation. But the problem with satisfaction, not wanting more or anything else, appeased or complacent, those aren't all the definitions, but these are the more problematic aspects of the definition, where we lose our motivation to keep learning and growing and challenging ourselves. Sometimes it seems like in our society that growth and learning and challenging ourselves, sometimes it seems in our culture like it is considered optional once you're past adolescence. Like, once you achieve adulthood, you know, good enough. It's just, as long as you're, you know, do your job, don't lie. I mean, some basic expectations, you know, more growth or understanding or learning or whatever is just, you know, that's nice if you want to do it, but it's not considered that central or even that possible. Sometimes we just stop really thinking that this is should be a central aspect of our lives. But I think this is part of the joys of practice, is that we recognize how much change we are capable of, no matter how old we are, no matter how entrenched our habits. Wow, it is possible to change them. It is possible to get insight into what's driving us and what is causing our dissatisfaction. Wow. So from the point of Buddhism, it's absolutely tragic to waste this opportunity of human life. So the Buddha told this story in the Pali Canon. He said, imagine that the whole earth is covered with ocean. So even bigger than the current oceans, like the whole earth is covered with ocean. And there's a blind sea turtle in the ocean. And it comes up once every 100 years. It just pokes its head up above the surface every 100 years. And he said, say you were to throw a yoke, like let's say a life preserver, right? Out into that ocean, what is the likelihood that in one of those 100-year surfacings, that sea turtle is going to stick its head right up through the middle of that yoke? That's how likely it is that we have ended up human beings capable of practice, encountering the Dharma, free to practice. So that's how Buddhism looks at our situation. That this is like, this is too precious an opportunity to waste. We're never, ever encouraged to say good enough. So there's this tension, right? Between we're going for satisfaction, but we also have these amazing ideals that are always meant to kind of remind us that more is possible. So a Buddha is an awakened being, an ideal of an awakened being. I don't know if Buddhas actually exist. I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical that any human being ever has really achieved Buddhahood. I mean, but I don't know. I can't prove they haven't, right? But even within Buddhism, the idea is that this is so rare that you only end up with like one Buddha per world system. So in this expansive universe, Buddhism assumes there's multiple world systems. And in each world system, so let's say in the Milky Way galaxy, there's just one Buddha, or probably even bigger, right? It's probably multiple galaxies. Only one Buddha, but this doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter if you believe it's possible to become such a perfect being or whether there ever has been one. We know you can be more Buddha-like. We know we ourselves can be more Buddha-like, and we know people who are more Buddha-like than we are, right? So that ideal is just as meaningful for orienting us as if, you know, a true Buddha were possible. So any growth is worth it. Any growth is noble and rewarding. So just to bring up these ideals as a way to, I would want to say, awaken dissatisfaction as a, perhaps to just a way to shake up satisfaction. If you're kind of feeling like, oh, I'm good enough, you know, I'm meditating, I've relieved my stress over time, and you know, I'll follow the precepts, I'm happier than I used to be, it's good, you know, like, in order to, you know, nudge that satisfaction. you know, so here's the Buddha qualities, which, if you know, these, the idea is that this is the potential that each of us has, where we have the divine abidings of goodwill, compassion, and sympathetic joy. And in the Buddha ideal, the Buddha, a Buddha, feels this freely and spontaneously for all beings without discrimination. Not just for nice beings, not just for the beings that they love, all beings. They feel goodwill, they feel compassion, they feel sympathetic joy without any sense of, you know, kind of selfishness. And I don't know if I want to extend compassion to that person. Just a boundlessness. And related to that is a generosity without the slightest concern for self. Almost all of us, anytime we're going to do something, offer something, you know, there's a little concern for like, am I going to have enough? I don't know. A boundless generosity. Equanimity based on insight. Of seeing what the true nature of the universe is. That all things are empty and boundless and interdependent. So for me, this feels like a Buddha compared to us might be something like us compared to a little child who has just broken their favorite crayon. And like, wah! And we're sympathetic, right? We say, oh, I know you really love that crayon. But from our perspective, you know, we know there's going to be more crayons, and next year they're going to use markers, and it's okay. We, from that perspective, we're not upset by that at all. And not because we're belittling the pain of the child, but just it's a bigger perspective. So that's what I think about is the perspective of awakened beings is just bigger. So they wouldn't get all freaked out about the stuff we get freaked out about, because they see it from a very different perspective. Awakened beings are deeply, authentically themselves, which is something that's really fascinating. It's like, you might think that, you know, with great spiritual insight and practice, you become just kind of everybody becomes the same. You just become like a saintly, kind of a generic saintly person. But in fact, what happens is people become just, they manifest as themselves more completely. That they're more individual, but not in a rigid way, not in a way that they're attached to. It's just become more authentically themselves through self-acceptance. And then, of course, skillfulness is when we really are able to get ourselves out of the way, we're much better able to perceive what is needed and respond in a skillful way to give what is needed, to know how to communicate, to respond. So that's just a few of these things that if we contemplate these, what's really possible and what each of us has an intuition at various times about what is possible within ourselves. I mean, that to me, that is where this kind of dissatisfaction arises, right? We know, we have a sense of what is possible within ourselves that we're not meeting or able to fulfill. And I feel like this kind of dissatisfaction is useful. So what do I mean by useful? Useful dissatisfaction is dissatisfaction about the choices you make, about the conscious choices you make, because that's the only thing that you have any influence over, any control over whatsoever. I mean, not that we often don't seem to really have control over it, but we have some influence, right? If anything, we have some influence over the conscious choices that we make. And I would say that to me is the definition of practice. Practice is about the conscious choices that we make in each moment, and also about how we live our lives and what practices we undergo to help strengthen or transform us. So useful dissatisfaction is about the choices that we make, as opposed to ordinary dissatisfaction. I'm dissatisfied with the state of the world or with my job or with my relationship or with this or with that. But the interesting thing is that we do need to be dissatisfied, right, with injustice when we witness it or the destruction of the planet or whatever, but it's not useful dissatisfaction until we trace it back to what choices are we going to make. So in a way, the dissatisfaction with, you know, say our political system, I don't know, I guess, you know, in that case, we do just try to accept and let go. But when it comes down to what should I do? How should I respond? I don't feel like I am doing enough, or I don't know that I fully understand, or something. There can be a point of dissatisfaction about our relationship to all of that. So once we have useful dissatisfaction, transforming that into bodhicitta. So I think a lot of times, most of us, that's all that we're familiar with is those negative karmic struggles of, all right, I see something I would like to change, but heck, that's really hard. Do I set an intention, then I fail in the intention? How do I change? So a lot of times, I guess that's part of why we resign ourselves to, like, well, you know, I don't really understand, but I probably never will, or I'm not able to respond or act in this way, but oh well, that's just who I am. But Dharma practice offers a different way to approach change. So there's ways to work on our body and mind. It's a holistic thing. And it's aimed at this gradual transformation. So there may be some particular thing, some particular understanding or foible or habit or whatever that we would really like to change, but we may or may not be able to get at that right away. But if we strengthen our practice in a larger sense, the likelihood that we can find a way to change what we want to change is greatly increased. So that dissatisfaction arises, there must be a better way. There must be more to life than this. And then we have to make that leap of faith that there is a way. I know when I was 24 and encountered the Dharma, I didn't think there was a way. I already felt dysfunctional and like there was nothing I could do about it. I tried, there's just nothing I could do about it. And then encountering Dharma practice, things started to shift and change just a little bit, but it was like, oh, look what I managed to do. Look, I changed how I responded. I changed how I viewed this thing. I changed how I related to this thing. Change is possible. So even just a little taste of that can give us more faith in the path of practice. So we have an intuition, we have our own experience. And then, to some extent, it's also trusting others, right? Trusting that this tradition, trusting teachers, trusting fellow practitioners, when you see, well, these people seem to have something going, and they say, I should do this, so I guess I'll give it a try. So there's a little bit of trust that we need to place in a tradition in order to move forward in it. And to have this grow this bodhicitta, which I'm defining right now as stubborn determination on behalf of ourselves and all beings to find a way to create positive change. If there is any possibility whatsoever, we will succeed. So it's that kind of thing, you know, it's the Bodhisattva vow. It's like, I'm not saying, all right, I've got stubborn determination on behalf of all beings to find a way to create positive change, but only if I'm guaranteed that there's going to be some positive change and I see it within a year. Then otherwise I'm out of here. Like it can't have that conditionality to it, right? It's like, I'm going to find a way. If there's any way, I'm going to find a way. So to quote Shanti Deva again, thus behold the utter frailty of goodness. Except for perfect bodhicitta, there is nothing able to withstand the great and overwhelming strength of evil. Those who wish to overcome the sorrows of their lives and put to flight the pain and sufferings of beings, those who wish to win such great beatitude should never turn their back on bodhicitta. So the promise of Dharma practice is that there's useful dissatisfaction because, I'm not sure exactly how to phrase this, but there is a reason for every limitation, for every point of suffering, for every point of tension or conflict. There is a spiritual reason for that. If you can trace it back to its source, it may not be immediately obvious, but essentially this is saying we have these various spiritual, mental, emotional ailments, and they can all be cured, which is a pretty big, bold statement, and a pretty encouraging and optimistic one. Now, are we going to be able to cure our limitation in this lifetime? Maybe, maybe not. You know, that's what I think, like, the Buddhist imagery of the multiple lifetimes is supposed to be kind of encouraging, right? If you don't do it this lifetime, it's not wasted. You get the next lifetime to do it. But I don't necessarily believe in that. But if you just think, even just in terms of this lifetime, say we don't cure this point of dissatisfaction, it still seems worth just working on it, of just engaging it as a koan. So my example, in myself, it's that many of you will heard about already, it's like, you know, managed to transform and shed quite a few bad habits and constrained frames of mind over the years, but I still, it's like the insights that I have managed to awaken to over the years don't translate so well into my body. So when I am going about my daily activities, cleaning and working and moving and driving and whatever, it's like the body has no sense of those great insights that I've had, right? That like the self is empty, it's all interdependent, everything is precious just as it is, blah, blah, blah. My body's like, God damn it! I mean, my body is like, I'm just an individual self here and I need to impose my will on the world and improve things and get things done, and I will fix everything if you just get out of my way. And it's like that. So in a way that raises the question for me is like, how, and I know I'm not alone in this koan, right? This is a human koan, but like, how do you take that, how do I awaken the body? How do I deepen that insight or integrate that insight? How do I bring it into the body? I don't know. But the promise of Dharma practice is there is a way. There is a way. I can find a way. I don't know if I will in this lifetime, right? But in theory, there is. And in theory, there's some kind of delusion or limitation or something I'm still holding on to that's obstructing me, and that can be resolved. So this means that over time, dissatisfaction is not so painful. I mean, dissatisfaction is actually enlivening. If you really recognize that the self is empty, there's no essence of Domio who is flawed or limited. There's no Domio that can be blamed or take credit. No core thing that is like inherently flawed. I just ended up in this karmic package, this body, this mind, this situation. Countless causes and conditions led me here. Some of them were my own choices. But I don't, no point in dwelling in blame about my past choices. I mean, I need to take responsibility for them and learn from them, but I can't undo them. So here I am. So when we look at it that way, it's just, you know, say, I used to be very, I struggled for many, many years in my monastic practice, just trying very hard and then failing and feeling inadequate and thinking like this, just, my Dharma brother over there, he can do it, I can't do it. Or my teacher can do it, I can't do it. I'm because of this flaw or that flaw or this limitation, that limitation. And I guess my worst nightmare at that time would have been to be able to just like leap into my teacher's head and see her looking at me and see and be able to read the thoughts that just said, I don't know. I don't think she's got it. I don't know. She's got too much going on here. She's really limited. She's can't really meditate very well. She's got, really full of anger. I don't know. And to really see like I am, I'm lame. I am like 3% a Buddha, and the chances that I'm going to get to 10% in this lifetime are very slim, right? That would have been like so devastating. And yet, if we really embrace the emptiness of self, who cares? So what? That doesn't change anything. As long as I practice wholeheartedly, I am, it's complete dignity, right? There's nothing lacking whatsoever. I just do the best with whatever I have. So therefore, dissatisfaction is not a sign of an inherently flawed self, I guess. Dissatisfaction is just natural. It's okay. We don't take it as personally. So I really find this is one of my favorite things about Dharma brothers and sisters, is when you can get together with folks, other fellow practitioners, and you can say, okay, how's your practice? You talk about your practice. And really what that means is, where are your points of dissatisfaction? Where are your points of limitation and tension or difficulty which you are practicing with in order to learn and grow? So it takes admitting, this is what's difficult for me right now, and this is how I am trying to use that habit of profound thought to look more deeply at it and really, really get something out of it. And when you talk about this, hopefully, with fellow practitioners, there's never a sense like of one-upmanship, oh, poor you and your failing and dissatisfaction. We just understand. I mean, all of us are inadequate compared to a Buddha. So you feel dissatisfied. That's good. That's good. It's as long as you're practicing with it, that's wonderful. And then you just say, oh, interesting. I look forward to hearing what you find out about that. I look forward to hearing what resolution or changes come out of that for you. So then there's this sharing of this, and able to process this kind of dissatisfaction in a safe way, because nobody's judging, and people give you, hopefully, give you credit for being able to practice. I know you can work with that. I know you can do that. I'm not going to give you advice about that. I know you can deal with it. So, yeah, it's important to open yourself up to dissatisfaction. I encourage you in the right way, useful dissatisfaction, as long as we also arouse bodhicitta, that determination that we can find a way, we will find a way to learn and grow and change and transform whatever difficulties we have. So with that, I will leave it and open it up to comments and questions. Just go ahead and unmute yourself, or if you're shy about just jumping in, go ahead and put your indicate in the chat that you want to say something. Ken.
Hi, thank you. First, I have two things. First, I want to say thank you to Jin Ryu, because is that Kokyo? She did a really good job, and I really appreciate, and I know it's not easy, and I think you did a really, really good job. It was very expansive for me.
I have to say, in all humility, thank you, and I skipped a line this morning.
Oh, you did? It was great. I saw you managing multiple things at multiple times, and it was great. So thank you. The other thing I'm thinking of is getting back to the beginning, more or less, of wishing us dissatisfaction. I recently saw the movie Samsara, which came out in 2011, and I highly recommend it, and let me tell you why. It's called Samsara, and you think, oh, okay, I know what this is going to be about. This is going to be about suffering and all these horrible things. And it's an art film, and it has no dialogue, and it's just cinematography with music. And 95% of the images are absolutely beautiful, and only 5% of the images cause you some sort of dissatisfaction or discomfort, like something should be done about this. And then at the end of the movie, spoiler alert, you realize that nirvana and samsara are the same thing. And that means that samsara is really beautiful, and in a lot of ways. And that gives me a little red flag, like Mara's knocking at the door. Like, so whenever things are really going well, I think, okay, well, let's not get too comfortable with this. Let's, it's a beautiful day. I had a beautiful day, but like, let's keep practicing, because that's Mara knocking at the door for me. That's what I was thinking of during your speech anyway. Thanks. Domio.
So, Domio, is the key to hanging in there with dissatisfaction, the ability to come to terms with the notion that very small changes for the good, in quotations, are enough. In other words, the ability to have a sense of equanimity regarding the realization that I am capable, it seems, of only very small positive changes. That would be, would that be something that you would consider as a key to hanging in with this sense of dissatisfaction?
Yeah, to me that sounds like what I was talking about in terms of the, letting go of our our preoccupation with self. Self is so important. How is this self doing? And because if we're measuring our improvements, right? Like this little improvement or it's a big improvement, and we're comparing it to our ideals or comparing it to other people or our own ideals. And I mean, it's the big and small is a preoccupation of the small self. How far am I? How far am I along the process? Is this worth it? Where I guess it feels like when we let go of that, you know, sense of small self to whatever extent we can, we realize like it's, you know, progress on the path of enlightenment is just progress on the path of enlightenment. It like, so our little insights and little changes partake of the same thing. I think at one point it was really transformative for me when I realized, you know, because I just always had this sense that, yeah, like I'm doing these little, I'm struggling along, grueling day by day, and then, but out here is some great like enlightenment thing. And those people over there have tasted it and whatever. It's a separate thing that I don't know about. But at some point, you know, and it's just, and another analogy that my teachers used was like, you're walking in the mist and you're wet. So it feels very gradual. And yet at some point I realized what I had already integrated was not of a different nature from enlightenment. It wasn't like it's two separate things. I'm doing the mundane stuff over here and there's enlightenment over there, but that I was tasting the same wisdom, the same enlightenment, just, you know, earlier along in a more gradual way. And as long as they don't compare, then it doesn't matter. Then we're just grateful for whatever growth and insight that we get to experience.
Domio, could I chime in? While you were speaking about dissatisfaction and limitations, and when you described the way you were wondering what your teacher was thinking about you, that brought to mind that a lot of the dissatisfaction and limitations and stuff, it's mind stuff. You're being identified with your mind. And that is what the purpose of all our practice is. The fact that we're meditating Zazen, eventually that practice should bring us into more presence. And that is how we make the progress. So those two things came together. Not to let your mind run you and tell you that you're dissatisfied and I'm limited this way, but by the practice of meditation is how we're going to eventually improve. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's our practice. That's what's so beautiful about a full tradition is it has so many different aspects and you don't necessarily know which ones are going to transform you. You know, that's what I really miss. I miss practicing in person, because then we can do like our physical ceremonies, right? You can bow to your seat and you can wash the teacups and you can, so there's different physical things that we do, which can also be incorporated into our home practice, of course. But like, is it the teachings or the chanting, the sitting or the precepts or the sangha or the, you know, we're getting it from all these different directions, and hopefully we'll soak it up. We don't know what'll change us, but yeah, those little narratives we create about who we are and how successful we are and what our practice is like and all that kind of stuff, yeah, that's not I guess where we want our dissatisfaction to come from, because we can always dream up dissatisfaction there, right? I guess when I think about this kind of useful dissatisfaction. It's really about, you know, what do I really, really want in this lifetime? What do I want? I want to be more appreciative of each moment. I want to be able to be more I want to be able to be active without losing touch with what is most essential. You know, to be active but not lose the big perspective at the same time. So there's all these little things that, like, these are things that it's not about my narrative about whether I'm successful or insufficient. It's about, you know, really in my heart what I want. So the dissatisfaction arising from there, like, I'm not satisfied yet with how I am.
The Zazen thing reminds me, I've been thinking lately that Zazen has many excellent properties, but one of them is that, you know, it's just this very traditional way to express our admiration for Buddhahood. Mm-hmm. And the aspiration towards Buddhahood. And, you know, suddenly Uchiyama Roshi's comment that Zazen is vow and repentance makes more sense to me now that I can see it that way. It all comes back to Zazen, always, somehow.
Well, and we're trying to sit like a Buddha, right? We're like, there's something very, very sweet about it. I mean, there's that one level at which, you know, we make an effort and it has an effect on us and it's good for us and all that kind of stuff. But at another level, there'd be something valuable about it, even if we just took the position. So,
I like that. It kind of reminds me of like we have toys for little kids that are like the little easy bake oven or the phone. And so they're not really on the phone, but they're like, you know, pretending to be on the phone. And we're going to do these grown-up things. And eventually, of course, they learn how to do those things. So I love that idea of you know, kind of admiring Buddhahood itself. But I was thinking about that dissatisfaction in a musical sense, in that the best artists, the best musicians are the ones who are dissatisfied with their playing, but they react to that in a positive way by, you know, woodshedding and practicing and studying. And then I've had, you know, like I don't teach lessons anymore, but I used to, and I had a couple of students that would just, they were very dissatisfied with their playing. And their answer to that was to just give up and not to try. So, yeah, I think that's just a principle that can apply to spiritual endeavors and anything else we endeavor to do. Good speech and good, I listened to the podcast too, so yeah, it's good.
And I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I spent so much of my junior practice just so self-preoccupied, so much like, oh, you know, either I'm oh so smart and great, or I'm oh so terrible and inadequate. And I mean, sometimes, like, if only my teacher had just, like, and she probably did, right? Just like, let it go. Like, any whining about yourself is just completely extra. It's completely aside. And yet that can just make you feel worse, right? If you are caught up in self-recrimination and somebody tells you self-recrimination is bad, then it can just make it even worse. But, you know, that sense is like, if only we could just, I mean, and we can almost imagine it better in other people than in ourselves, because as you were talking, so Ona, I was thinking about, you know, you wouldn't feel any judgment, right? You, I would hope, for somebody who's playing the guitar and they're just not all that naturally talented, but they enjoy it and they want to get better and they keep playing and they've learned and they've improved a little bit, and they're never going to be a concert guitarist, right? They're never, but if they're doing it with that kind of sincerity and enjoyment of the process, and, you know, so I can imagine just really, you know, being touched by someone like that who just enjoyed it and did their best and learned and actually did make some progress, even though they're kind of lame. You know, can we be like that in our practice instead of it being contingent on some kind of particular result? A kind of humility of just engaging the process instead of, you know, I need to be achieved such and such in this lifetime, otherwise it's not worth it.
Yeah, it's like a value judgment on sucking. And I told my students, they'd say, I suck. And I'd say, well, of course you suck. You just started. If you keep practicing, then you won't suck anymore. So I think it's this value judgment. You know, if you're beginning at something, you of course you're not Buddha yet. Yeah. Of course you're not in life yet.
Well, you remind me of Shinryu Suzuki, who we all, so many of us think of as like, oh, Shinryu Suzuki, Zen mind, beginner's mind. Oh, he's so wise and sweet and such a great example. And his teacher called him Crooked Cucumber. His teacher was like, oh, oh, this one. Why did I end up with this one? This one's never going to make it. Funny.
Hey, I know we're getting close to time. I just keep thinking of dissatisfaction for me is like friction. And and for me, that's a catalyst. So as long as I'm not judging it or getting in my head about it, it's a good thing because it pushes me along the path, you know? And a lot of it is just not being in my head about it, you know, and that's almost like a trust issue. And then the other thing is, I don't know if anyone else is feeling this, but I just keep hearing Mick Jagger. Now I have satisfaction in my head. The minute you started talking, I got the Stones on my brain. So I'll definitely have to crank some Stones after this talk. So thank you for that as well.
Oh, I love it. Love it. I know. I realized, like, I have to admit, Dharma practice can kind of ruin your ability to socialize in a normal way. Maybe it doesn't for you, but I know it has. I don't know if it's always great at it. I was never great at it, but when I am talking with people, I mean, you know, because generally you're going to talk about, oh, I did this thing and it was great and we're enjoying this and blah, blah, blah. And I got this, you know, we had our house remodeled and looks nice and we're planning on this vacation and it's good stuff, right? But I just want to hear about how you're dissatisfied. I just want to hear about what are you working with? What are you struggling with? And it sounds kind of negative, right? So I don't usually, in a social situation, I'm like, you know, what's really bumming you out? What, you know, what's limiting your intimacy? But that's, that, you know, that I immediately perk up when somebody mentions that, because then that's about the engagement. That's about the exploration, the learning. That's what I want to hear about. All right, it is 12:15. So abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna param. And all of you who are members, you should have received a chant book in the mail. So
I did. It's wonderful.
It is wonderful.
I mean, that is a lot of work. I want you to know how much it's appreciated.
Yeah.
They're really wonderful.
And it's available on the website, like just as a PDF as well. And if you should want a physical copy and you don't have one, I might be able to be enticed to send you one. All right.
Cool. Very grateful for the book.
Yeah.
Yes.
It'll be a nice, you know, we won't have to make another one for 10 years. It's yeah. It's done.
Happy New Year.
Bye. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks for the talk to
see you all.